Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batson. The Supreme Court and the candidacy of Donald Trump for the Republican nomination for the presidency 2024. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, writing for Defining Ideas about questions at hand. I read from The Atlantic within these last hours, George Conway. Donald Trump is well on his way to becoming history's greatest litigation loser ever. But in the multi-front war of Trump versus seemingly everyone else, he has just prevailed in one small skirmish, the battle of the questions presented. Late Friday afternoon, just hours before this moment, the Supreme Court of the United States agreed to review the Supreme Court of Colorado's decision that held Trump ineligible to serve again as president under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the provision barring insurrectionists from public office. I end there because Richard has thoughts about this in terms of what are the available interpretations of Section 3. Remember, this was written at a time following the Civil War when the question at hand was citizenship for some of the enslaved peoples of the South, some males, and the question of what to do with the Confederate office holders, generals, bad actors who had rebelled against the United States and were seeking entrance again into the United States' power corridors as congressmen, as senators, as governors from the rebellious states. That was when it was written. But now, Richard, a very good evening to you. As I understand it, the Section 3 has become a major piece of dispute between scholars such as yourself and between judges who are to find whether it does or does not apply. We'll presume that it applies in this instance. And the language of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, is, to my reading as an amateur, ambiguous. You concentrate in your defining ideas piece on two pieces of it. One is the question of what is self-executing, and the other is enforcement. What do you mean by self-executing in Section 3? Good evening to you, Richard.
Yeah, well, the term self-executing applies very much to one key provision of the Constitution, which is the first portion of the 14th Amendment, the Citizenship Clause, which announces that every person born in the United States and a resident in a particular state is a citizen of the United States and of the state in which he resides. And this was, of course, designed to make sure that everybody who had been a slave in the South now had their status automatically moved. There was no further legislation that was needed in order to change this. So the reason why it was self-executing is the moment the Constitution provision is put into place, the status of every individual in the United States is automatically changed. There is nothing that legislation need to do in order to make it happen. And there's nothing that legislation could do in order to prevent it from happening. And then in Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, it says that Congress have the power to enforce this by appropriate legislation. And what that means, if somebody tries to deny somebody who's been granted citizenship under the Constitution, the Congress is supposed to make sure that its guarantees are good. So that's the simple kind of case. And when you get to Section 3 of the Constitution, there's no way that it can be self-executing, at least in a modern context. Back in 1868, it didn't take a genius to figure out who was an insurrectionist. Was anybody who served in an official capacity in the Confederacy, in the military, or on the civil side, right? And then what happened, there were procedures to make sure that these individuals could be neutralized if it turned out to be appropriate. And so the first of them has to do with how it is that you select key officials in the United States. And the section begins, it doesn't apply to any person. It's important to read the language. It says it applies to any congressman, any senator, and any elector for the president or the vice president of the United States. These are the people who are specifically named. The president is not put on the list at all. And there's a perfectly good reason why he would be kept off of that particular list. The president is going to be chosen by a national election, which has the complicated situation through the Electoral College. And what happened is they wanted to make sure that no state can unduly influence that particular process by having key people take the position of electors in these various elections. And so what happens is they cannot do it if they're revolutionaries, insurrectionists, unless there's a waiver given from Congress for them to do so. The president is not on that list because if you purify the Electoral College, then you just have to do it in the ordinary way. And in fact, the only mechanism for enforcement, the second problem you raise, is in the last clause, which says that by a two-thirds vote of each house, you could waive these disabilities. The president never goes through that particular cycle. He is chosen by an Electoral College. And so it is widely understood, if you read the full document, not just snippets of the word, the president is simply not covered by this. He is not an officer of the United States for the purposes of the next clause. He is the person who appoints all the officers of the United States under the Appointments Clause, some with Senate confirmation and some without Senate confirmation. And so what happens is he is just not part of this particular process. The remedy doesn't work against him in the last clause. And the whole institutional setup indicates that we do quite well if we let the presidency go to the political process rather than treating it as something which is done automatically foreclosed by a finding of an insurrection under a set of rules which are nowhere defined whatsoever anywhere in the Constitution.
You know very well the distinguished scholar and jurist Michael Luttig has spoken of the self-executing clause in Section 3, and he's compared it to the self-execution of another part of the constitutional amendments, that is the age requirement to become president of the United States. How does the self-execution of the age requirement not inform the self-execution of declaring someone an insurrectionist? Doesn't that mean they're immediately...
Luttig has been one of the most irresponsible persons on this issue that I've heard in a very long time. Look, what happens if somebody decides to run for president and he's 33, you don't have to have a great hearing on what age means. You simply kick him off the ballot because he turns out to be ineligible. And it's an open and shut case. In this particular situation, he assumes that the definition of an insurrection, and he always gives the wrong one, has the same degree of clarity associated with the other operation. To put it in a similar kind of fashion, nobody would regard knocking a 32-year-old off the ballot who's trying to run for president as an assault on the political process. But everybody, at least I certainly think many, many people say, if you take the leading Republican candidate, whether you like him or not, and run him off under a definition of insurrection, which is simply beyond belief, this is not self-executing. This is not even clear. What you have to do is you don't even have a procedure. And so, for example, take the age requirement. If they want to put you on a ballot in one state, you know exactly where you go. But in this thing, you're running for president. And now what we're going to do is have a ragtag assembly of 50 different states, each with its own election laws, trying to pass on the insurrection requirement when there's no agreement about the definition and no understanding of what the procedure should be. To say that an automatic ministerial action like age is a precedent that makes everything work with respect to everything else is just a bizarre expansion of the rule. And that's one of the things that's so terrible about all of these attacks is they gin up all sorts of weird and novel arguments nowhere made in the history of the United States in order to get somebody. And the real test is there isn't a single person who's out to get Trump on the insurrection issue who would ever vote for him. Indeed, they find it quite intolerable that he's president. So you read all of these columns and they say, oh, if he's elected president, democracy is going to come to an end. He's going to basically try to suppress all of his opposition. Well, what are they doing? They're doing exactly the same thing. I want to be fairly clear about this. I called for Donald Trump's resignation, as you recall, as early as 2017. This is not one of his, shall we say, franchise supporters speaking it, but I regard this as perhaps the most destabilizing and dangerous movement that I've ever seen in the history of American politics. And I think Luttig's at the center of it. And I think, in fact, he has made very, very bad judgments on this thing from start to finish.
The Colorado Supreme Court was a 4-3 decision. Does that matter, that it wasn't unanimous, that it was very contentious, and that it's going to the Supreme Court in what you'd have to say shadow?
Yeah, look, I think the simplest way in order to put the point is, if you're trying to do something utterly unprecedented and utterly dramatic, what you do is you demand that it meet a very high standard of proof. And so if you think back to Brown v. Board of Education, how would that case have played out if it had gone 5-4? So that's the first point. And secondly, I mean, the substantive standards that you have to impose have to be fairly strict. And the definition that they gave of an insurrection in the Colorado case would cover two guys standing at a polling site, keeping out some voters on the hope that they can influence the election to come out their way. And that, under their definition, counts as an insurrection. Well, this is bizarre. That's obstruction of elections. That's all it is. And whatever you want to say about Trump, he may have committed other kinds of offenses. But using insurrection and rebellion, you then have to analogize this to the Civil War or to the revolutions and the insurrections that we've had elsewhere. And all of them are prolonged. All of them have armed forces fighting against the United States. And in this particular case, you don't even have a guy who's present. The entire episode lasts for 3 or 4 hours. He was a dummkopf, that is, he was a fool when he didn't call people to come away from it, but he certainly didn't inspire them to go there. And if you have to look at the evidence so closely to figure out whether or not this guy was engaged in an action of free speech and protesting the outcome or an insurrection, those are opposite poles. You cannot, in effect, put the thumb on the scale to make it appear as though all factual difficulties should be resolved in favor of the prosecution rather than in favor of a particular defendant. And so that's yet another problem that we have in this case. This case should have never been there because the president's not covered by the 14th Amendment for the reasons I've said. But even if it was, to show that he personally was engaged in a revolution or in an insurrection, based upon what he did sitting in his own room talking to a bunch of people, this is, I think, beyond the pale. And it's a real tragedy that language can be so debased in political purposes. So that all I would say about former Judge Luttig is he's engaged in the absolute kind of abuse that he's accusing the president of being into. And it's not just him. He's been subject to suits in Atlanta and in Georgia, suits in New York State of one kind or another. He's been besieged everywhere. And it's all with one particular purpose. All of these people believe that Trump has a very good chance of winning because Biden is likely to be the Democratic nominee, and it's not even clear that he could walk across the stage unassisted, plus all the difficulties with his policy. So they're trying to knock somebody out in this way, and I don't believe that the Supreme Court is going to tolerate it. And if, in fact, it says, oh, he's an insurrectionist and that he is now barred from the election, there will be a level of civil dis-ease and uncomfort in this country that never existed before. And I just regard this as the most irresponsible form of hype, trying to take a very difficult and contentious period and making it work so by a group of people who know at this particular point that with their candidate and his policy, they cannot win the election.
Then we come to the issue of enforcement when we come back. Professor Richard Epstein, writing at Defining Ideas for the Hoover Institution, where he's a senior fellow. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. This is about the Supreme Court decision on February 8th, we're told, within 30 days, to take up the question of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, written in a completely different age. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
At CVS, it matters that we're not just in your community, but that we're part of it. It matters that we're here for you when you need us, day or night. And we want everyone to feel welcomed and rewarded. It matters that CVS is here to fill your prescriptions and here to fill your craving for a tasty and, yeah, healthy snack. At CVS, we're proud to serve your community because we believe where you get your medicine matters. So visit us at cvs.com or just come by our store. We can't wait to meet you. Store hours vary by location.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.